Okay, I'm going to try something a little different today. I hope it doesn't disturb anybody that I've ruined the symmetry of the room here. But this enables me to be able to see what's on the screen, which sometimes is an advantage. If I had the computer right here, it's not an issue. But anyway, thanks for coming back. This is the third installment of A Candle Against the Dark. We're talking today about the Reformed Presbyterian anti-slavery doctrine. There we are. The Church Anti-Slavery Society, holding its 1860 annual meeting in Boston's spacious Tremont Temple. Tremont Temple Baptist Church is still there. It's a much larger building than this now. It's just up the street, about a block or block and a half from Park Street Church, which many of us are familiar with. But this Church Anti-Slavery Society listened in rapt attention as the distinguished speaker thundered against the defenders of slavery. He said, "It is not upon the abuses of slavery that we insist. There are no abuses of slavery, as there are none of murder, none of adultery." You know, we can't say, well, I'm opposed to adultery, but, you know, a little bit is okay. Or I'm opposed to murder, but, you know, I wouldn't impose my preferences on somebody else. He says it does not apply to slavery. There are no abuses of slavery. It is of itself inherently sinful, an evil in itself, at once to be repented of and abandoned. So the Reverend J.R. W. Sloan, pastor of the Third Reformed Presbyterian Church in New York, exhorted his audience. This theme was a consistent note in the anti-slavery doctrine of the Covenanters, as well as the foundation of the Interdenominational Church Anti-Slavery Society. While this belief was far from universal among abolitionists, that is, that slavery is a sin, there were a lot of abolitionists that were opposed to slavery but didn't regard it as a sin, per se. But it was shared by many, and has been embodied, well, it was embodied in the Free Democratic Party platform in 1852, 8 years before Lincoln was nominated and elected. At the same time that the Covenanters were talking about slavery as a sin, the eminent theologians Charles Hodge of Princeton and Moses Stewart of Andover Seminary both opposed slavery, but refused to say that in itself it was a sin. Having looked earlier at the activities of some of the leading Reformed Presbyterians in the anti-slavery cause and the deep-seated consistency of their opposition, the question obviously arises, why were they so strongly opposed to a practice which was embodied in custom and constitution? Were there reasons? Or were they, in the words of historian Timothy L. Smith, simply numbered among the screwballs? Well, to combat slavery, its foes had access to a variety of lines of attack, all of which were used by some of the movement, some in the movement, some of the time. It seemed that each of the enemies of the peculiar institution found some arguments persuasive and others unconvincing. Not surprisingly, the advocates of slavery found none persuasive until the final argument, which was war. Only when used in combination, and only when the issue was forced by the slave power, did these arguments finally tip the national scales of justice toward the center. In the memorable words of historian Mark A. Knoll, and I'm sorry, this it's legible when you're looking at it closer, so I apologize for some illegibility there. But in the memorable words of historian Mark Knoll, And I quote, "For the history of theology in America, the great tragedy of the Civil War is that the most persuasive theologians were the Reverend Doctors William Tecumseh Sherman and Ulysses S. Grant." Well, let's list these types of arguments and then look at each of them in a little more depth. The arguments against slavery could be ethical, moral and social, humanitarian, economic, and political, and finally, biblical. The earliest of these arguments in America were ethical. During the colonial period, these were seldom mentioned. Puritan ministers and judges saw no inconsistency in owning black slaves. Part of the ethical dilemma resulted from the New Testament word doulos in Greek, which is avat in Hebrew and servus in Latin, and it could be legitimately translated as servant, bondservant, or slave. Only when the Enlightenment brought about conversations on the natural rights of mankind did a widespread sense of unease about perpetual slavery arise. The revolutionary generation wrote that all men are created equal. Okay, that's about the confusion of language. It was the Enlightenment that said all men are created equal, but failed to consider the racial meaning of all or to include women in the distribution of divinely created equality. Both friends and foes of slavery usually did not distinguish between the issues of race and slavery. As we'll see, Reformed Presbyterians were among the first white abolitionists to make this distinction and to reject the widespread belief in the alleged inferiority of blacks. Admitting blacks to church membership on an equal footing, sanctioning interracial marriage, and so on. A related issue in Enlightenment sentiment was both moral and social. The debilitating or coarsening effects of the slave system on young white men and women. They grew up expecting to command and to be obeyed. They were schooled from childhood in cruelty as they saw their parents and the slave drivers whipping slaves and so on, keeping them in shackles and all kinds of cruelty that were visited on them. Their finer sensibilities were calloused by regular exposure to legally sanctioned suffering. Adolescent and adult white males, expected to command the favors of female slaves. White youth were, to use a popular modern expression, victims of the system. Moreover, since a significant part of their inheritance and fortune was invested in slave property, they were helpless to change or abolish the system. In the North, New Englander Jedediah Morse, in 1789, noted that, quote, "Slavery is the bane of industry. It renders labor among the whites not only unfashionable, but disreputable." In other words, labor was something that ought to be left to the blacks. It was beneath the dignity of whites. The third kind of argument was humanitarian, which is not actually moral reasoning when it comes to the logic of it, but it was an appeal to human pity. It emphasized the cruelties inflicted on slaves in the form of whippings and other humiliations, sexual exploitation, the destruction of families, and the devastation, the deprivation of literacy and of the Bible. The success of Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, showed that it successfully moved people towards abolition. And in a famous but unfortunately apocryphal story, when Mrs. Stowe was introduced to President Lincoln, he said, "So you're the little woman who started this big war." Alexander MacLeod had insisted in 1802 that Christians had a moral responsibility to empathize with the sufferings of the slaves, as well as those who suffered from other causes. While very sympathetic to the slaves' suffering, Covenanters recognized that cruelty was an essential element of the slave system because it was necessary in order to control the slaves. Slavery requires cruelty. But the sin consists in the relation, as J.R.W. Sloan said, the relation of owner and servant, or the ownership and servitude, not in the cruel behavior primarily. It would still be sin if there were no cruel behavior connected with it. But because slavery was a sin in itself, cruelty was an auxiliary sin which increased the guilt of the slave owner. A fourth type of argument was economic rather than moral or theological. First, it was sometimes thought that the slave owner, that the slave labor was less expensive than the hire of free labor, and so provided an unfair economic advantage to slave owners. This was apparent if a small farmer, for example, owned no slaves and so was compelled to hire workers or to rely on the help of his wife and children in the fields or to reduce the scope of his farming operations, farm less land. While his slave-owning neighbors flourished and extended their farms by using allegedly cost-free slave labor. It was also apparent that when a factory owner was able to buy or rent slave labor, which often happened, I mean, they were rented out very often. Parenthetically, that's how Frederick Douglass was able to escape. He was rented out, and then he was able to escape from that instead of straight off the plantation. But when the factory owner was able to buy or rent slave labor at a lower cost than hiring free workers for the same jobs, he depressed the market for free laborers. Statistically, however, evidence showed that the economy of the slave South was less productive than that of the non-slave North. In 1789, Jedediah Morse had pointed out, from repeated and accurate calculations, it has been found that the expense of maintaining a slave, if we include the purchase money, is much greater than that of maintaining a free man. And the labor of the free man, influenced by the powerful motive of gain, is at least twice as profitable to the employer as that of the slave. Mid-century statistics showed how far the free states exceeded the slave states economically. In 1850, the 16 free states had a total valuation of real and personal property of $4.1 billion, including, of course, no unfree people. The 15 slave states had $2.9 billion in total valuation, including 3.2 million slaves. The value of the hay crop alone in the free states in that year had a retail value more than four times the value of all the cotton produced in the United States that year. In 1856, for another example, the real and personal estate valuation of New York City alone was $511 million, which was far more than the entire state of Virginia. It was perfectly clear from these facts that slavery did not produce prosperity or foster production. Some advocates for slavery turned this argument about efficiency on its ear. True enough, they said, owning slaves, which entailed the responsibility to provide food, clothing, shelter, and medical care, cost more than the slave earned in production. Slave owning was economically counterproductive. So, they said, slave owners should be reckoned benefactors of mankind, providing philanthropically for a helpless and incapable race, generously sacrificing their own well-being for the good of the Africans and the protection of white society. It hardly needs to be said that this argument is laughable, but incredibly, it had its followers. In the fifth place, the North had a powerful and legitimate political argument against the slave system in the federal ratio, by which three-fifths of the slaves were counted in the population for purposes of representation in Congress and in the Electoral College. Slaves couldn't vote, of course. They were regarded by state law in the South as chattels, and counting 60% of them as though they were people significantly skewed political power in favor of whites, in favor of slave states. The extra representatives represented not the slaves, not the poor whites, but the slave owners. And the slave states used their power to the fullest, in fact, in national politics by, for one thing, blocking attempts to limit the expansion of slaveholding, by insisting on the admission of new states that permitted slavery, and by dominating the presidency. 10 of the first 16 presidents were from the slave states, and the Supreme Court. Since Congress had fixed no minimum population for the formation of a new state, a number of new slave states were very thinly populated. In the 1850s, six slave states had a total population 190,000 fewer than Pennsylvania. But of course, with six states, they had 12 senators versus two from Pennsylvania. So that's how the slave power developed its imbalance. And it gave, this imbalance is what gave rise to the term the slave power. Politically, periodically created crises in government, which in turn required further compromises, those of 1820 and 1850 in particular. In addition to these ethical, social, humanitarian, economic, and political arguments, was a sixth line of reasoning, biblical. This type of argument was unacceptable to many people in the 19th century, just as it is today. The defenders of slavery offered literalistic Bible verses, quoting Bible verses, to support their position. But theological or biblical reasoning was foundational to the anti-slavery thinking of many Americans, including the Covenanters. The earliest systematic exposition of the Covenanter position was Alexander MacLeod's Negro Slavery Unjustifiable, which was printed in 1802, and I found a record of a reprint edition of it as late as 1869, after the war was over. It went through a number of editions. The text for MacLeod's discourse is Exodus 21:16. He that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. This was a political law for the Hebrew nation, but because it's grounded in the moral law, MacLeod argued, it is obligatory still on every subject of moral argument. In other words, on every person. It's based on the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. If a person who steals such possessions as money is guilty of sin, a person who steals someone's father, brother, wife, or child cannot be innocent. Moreover, as a person who knowingly buys stolen property is held to be complicit in the theft, so one who buys, holds, or sells a stolen person also shares in the guilt. Perpetual slavery, he says, is inconsistent with the natural rights of man, by which he means the rights conferred by God at creation, rather than the Enlightenment's meaning of rights as the essence of humanity. The rights of man, in other words, he said, are not inherent but derived from God. A person's life and faculties are the gifts of God. No one has a right to take them unless he has forfeited them by crime. The opposite principle would be absurd. Everyone would have a right to sell and enslave everyone else, in which case law becomes raw force. Justice becomes cunning. And here's a second quotation. We heard a quotation from Hobbes in the sermon. There's another quotation from him, a nightmare of all against all. Everybody can capture everybody else and enslave them, if you follow the logic of that. Slavery, moreover, he says, contradicts the general tenor of sacred scriptures, including Jesus' command to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. When apologists of slavery assert the inferiority of blacks, they violate the reality of creation expressed in Acts 17:26. I'm sorry, I am getting ahead of myself. Oops. I don't know how to back up on this. There we go. Acts 17:26, God has made of one blood all the nations of the earth. That was a verse that covenanters kept returning to in the argument against racism. Slavery, MacLeod says, clearly violates four of the Ten Commandments. The fifth commandment requires that children obey their parents in the Lord. But under slavery, children are taught to obey the master rather than their parents in everything. The sixth commandment not only prohibits taking the life of another, but by implication requires people to preserve and protect the lives of others. Under slavery, however, the lives of the slaves are at the absolute whim of the master. The lives of slaves were held to be of no value beyond their retail or market price. The eighth commandment, which prohibits stealing, is violated because slavery robs the slave of the fruit of his labor except for whatever food and clothing is graciously granted by the master. Finally, he says, the tenth commandment, which forbids covetousness, is violated because the slave owner is avaricious. He employs servants without wages, enriches himself from the coerced labor of others, and sells his slaves to the highest bidder for financial gain. MacLeod also said that slavery violates the gospel of free grace. That is, the slaves are in the same position, that is, in sin, and in the same need for salvation, as the owners are. There's no use pretending that the owner is better than the slave morally. They're brothers. McLeod also refuted the most common arguments in favor of slavery. Once again, I'll list them all before looking at each in a little more detail. These arguments for slavery were that Africans are inherently inferior, that Negroes are a different species or even a different race, different race or species even, from whites. The third argument was that Negroes are cursed because they're descendants of Noah's son, Ham. Fourth, God permitted the ancient Hebrews to own slaves. In the New Testament, Christ and the apostles did not condemn slavery. And finally, we found them as slaves. We inherited them, and there's nothing we can't, with them, nothing we can do about it. So McLeod takes these up in turn. First was the claim that that Africans are inherently inferior to Americans and Europeans, and, quote, it is just for the more intelligent to rule the less intelligent. They're miserable in Africa anyway, and they're no worse off being enslaved here. But McLeod says the apparent inferiority of blacks is a result of circumstances. They have been willfully and forcefully held in illiteracy and ignorance. Even if they were less intelligent, which he vigorously denies, it does not follow that they should be enslaved. They still would have the same fundamental God-given right to liberty and self-determination. The second and closely related argument was that Negroes are a different race or species from whites. They clearly cannot be descended from the same pair, Adam and Eve. As early as 1774, the Englishman Edward Long had developed a racial hierarchy in which blacks were situated between Europeans and orangutans. As late as 1906, a Congolese man of the Mbuti tribe of so-called pygmies, which we now call forest peoples, a man named Otabenga, was placed in a cage in the Bronx Zoo and labeled the missing link between orangutans and the white race. In fact, an orangutan was put in the same cage with him. As the most readily available response, McLeod pointed first to Acts 17:26. God has made from one man, every nation of mankind to live on the face of all the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. McLeod then points out that there are individual differences within every species. Climate, diet, and other variables, particularly over a long span of time, explain the differences observed among people. Again, he turns to the device of reversing the argument. If that argument were true, he says, it would prove too much, as any nation might claim superiority of rank over any other nation, and once again, violence would be the only basis for law. If you could beat me, I was your slave. If I beat you, you were my slave. One of the most popular biblical arguments in favor of slavery was that the Negroes were cursed because, according to the account of Noah's family in the book of Genesis, they are descendants of Ham and so are forever enslaved. McLeod makes short work of this argument. First, the curse was directed to Canaan, the son of Ham, according to Genesis 9:25. Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers. Even if Africans were descended from Ham, they were almost certainly not descended from Canaan, because Genesis 10:19 identifies the territory of the Canaanites, the descendants of Canaan, as Syria-Palestine. That is, they were among the nations expelled from the promised land when the Israelites conquered it. There's nothing in the biblical account to indicate that all of Canaan's descendants were condemned to perpetual and eternal slavery. Moreover, he says, that curse was a prediction and not a rule of duty. God has given many peoples over to slavery in the course of history, but the tyrants and murderers who ruled over them, such, for example, as Egypt, Babylon, and Rome, were held accountable by God. Finally, he says, if the curse of Ham argument were to hold water, every slave owner would need somehow to prove that he's descended from Shem or Japheth in order to avoid being enslaved himself. And those of you who do genealogy know that it's hard to trace back 8 or 9 generations in most families, but to try to trace ancestry from the 19th century American South clear back to Shem and Japheth obviously would be impossible. The fourth objection to ending American slavery was that God permitted the ancient Israelites to hold slaves. True enough, McLeod says, but not relevant to modern nations and the modern style of slavery, which was absolute and permanent. Like other ancient peoples, under the prevailing customs of war, the Hebrews could use prisoners captured during war as slaves. Israelites themselves could be sold into servitude for theft or insolvency. But, in any case, even a thief, for one thing, could not be sold into servitude so long as he had enough property to repay the theft. And if an Israelite were impoverished and indebted, he could be forced into servitude, but not with rigor, as the King James Version has it. In either case, the maximum term of service was 6 years. And after that, of course, would come the year of Jubilee, the Sabbath of the land. And when a debtor was set free, his master was required to give him some livestock to go into business again. Deuteronomy 15, 12 to 15. Foreigners could be acquired as slaves, but the same laws applied to them which applied to the Hebrews. Leviticus 24 says, one manner of law as well for the stranger as for one of your own country. Additionally, the Israelites were not authorized to send ships to distant lands to steal or buy, chain and torture people who had done them no harm. They had no precedent for that, no divine approval, and no instances in their history. And McLeod was perhaps the earliest. It's also always dangerous for a historian to say this is the first. But McLeod was perhaps the first person to make this particular argument that the Israelites weren't authorized to send ships to get slaves. The fifth objection offered by the advocates of slavery was that in the New Testament, Christ and the apostles do not condemn slavery as it existed under Greek and Roman law. That, says McLeod, is untrue as well as irrelevant. Untrue because Paul, in 1 Timothy 1:10, condemns man-stealers, which can also be translated slave traders. In 1 Corinthians 7:21, he advises slaves to procure their freedom if they can, but if not, to continue patiently. In Colossians 4:1, he directs masters to treat their servants justly, mercifully, and with fair wages. In any case, the argument is irrelevant because it would not be reasonable to construct a system of ethics upon all the realities of Roman society that are not expressly condemned in Scripture. Feeding Christians to the lions, for instance, as you see on the left side of the screen, is not specifically prohibited in the Bible. But that didn't make it ethically permissible. It was still wrong. A sixth argument in favor of slavery said, in effect, yes, the practice is wrong, but here they are. We found them as slaves and we can't do anything about it. McLeod rephrases this argument. This is one of his favorite gimmicks. You're getting a picture of this. Take the slave owner's point of view and rephrase it. See what it can say. He rephrases the argument. These advocates say a long continuance of evil doing will change the nature of wrong into right. If the first stealer and the first buyer sinned in enslaving their victims, the man who continues the crime continues the guilt. The best preparation, he says, is to set the slave free at once. The passage of time does not change the moral law. The passage of time does not change the moral law. Christians, says McLeod, have an obligation to empathize with the sufferings of the slaves. This is not a situation to be contemplated coolly or merely theoretically. The slaves are our brothers, human beings who are to be commended to the God of mercy and comfort. Christians must do anything in their power to alleviate the sorrows of the slaves. Ministers have a duty to preach and teach on the subject. Speaking the truth in apt circumstances. Legislators and statesmen must exercise their responsibilities to work quickly to correct this evil practice. Throughout the anti-slavery era, Reformed Presbyterians consistently emphasized the biblical theological theme that slavery is a sin of the whole nation. We can't just point to the southern states and say they are sinning. The whole nation is involved in this sin. In an unsigned essay in the magazine The Reformed Presbyterian in 1838, we find the argument that because holding people in slavery is sinful, and because it's protected by the federal constitution, the whole nation is guilty. That is, all the citizens who belong to a nation so constituted. The slave states are guilty of slavery, and because the free states have joined with them in the federal constitution, they too are guilty. Now, it's true that the Union didn't create slavery, but it gave it national sanction. The argument continued, if it is wrong for an individual to hold slaves, it is wrong for a state to permit him to do so. But if it's wrong for a state, it is equally wrong for a number of states to recognize it in their national confederacy. Moreover, continuing to admit slave states makes the sin a national one. Slavery in the District of Columbia can't be blamed on a state. It's the act of the national government. So, when opponents of slavery argued the sinfulness of slavery, many of its proponents turned not to defend against this charge, but fall back on its constitutionality. We've got a right under the Constitution to own these slaves. Look at Article whatever it is. So they fell back on that, believing that that answered every attack. But that is neither a moral nor a rational defense. If the Constitution is wrong, depending on its reasoning to enforce your point of view is also wrong on that point. My next point may appear to be extraneous here, but really it is relevant. That is that the Covenanters had a distinctive theory of the state. That developed during the 16th and 17th centuries, but its classical exposition is particularly articulated in Samuel Rutherford's book, Lex Rex, or The Law is King, first published in 1644. 2 points are especially relevant to our topic. First, Reformed Presbyterians argued that every government must acknowledge the authority and law of Jesus Christ in its foundation, that is, in its constitution, and seek to make its laws conform to the will of God. And along with that, the second point was that church and state each must pursue its God-given function under God, free of control by the other. The church does not run the state, and the state does not run the church. These are the reasons underlying RP political activism, even today. They were calling the United States to honor Christ by obeying what the scriptures, reason, ethics, morality, and compassion teach about slavery. The long history of the Covenanters showed that for them, the underlying, the fundamental issue was not slavery, but freedom. Their ancestors had been denied freedom in Scotland. More recent ancestors had fought for freedom in America in the Revolution. And in the plan of God, freedom was the norm for human life. Anything which prevented human beings from freedom was therefore sin and to be opposed. The principle which they expressed, that man cannot hold ownership in man, was held to be true regardless of skin tone, intellectual ability, or any other considerations. RPs relied heavily on the account of creation in Genesis and on Paul's statement in Acts 17:26. Here we come again. God hath made of one blood all the nations of the earth. The necessary corollary of that, if you believe what God said there, is that all people are brothers. All are created by the same God and given the same fundamental rights and responsibilities. This left no room for enslaving one race, no room for enslaving any race in perpetuity, and no room, no justification for either shame or arrogance about one's race or national origin. You'll remember that we talked about the RP congregation of Coldenham, New York, in our first time together in connection with eliminating slavery from among the church. Turning once again to Coldenham, we see that one of the early stages of racial integration was at work in the denomination. By 1817, the pastor was James Renick Wilson. 2 years after his installation, the first black member was admitted, a man named Jephthah Williams. From then until his death 32 years later, Williams brought over 60 new black members into the church, including 13 families. Part of the reason he left the Goodwill Presbyterian Church to join the Covenanters was his discovery that blacks could be buried in the Coldenham churchyard, unlike the Goodwill Church. It seems kind of ironic, doesn't it, that the Goodwill Church would not allow people of another race to be buried there. A challenge in 1839 showed that not all of the white members of the congregation were free of racism. The session adopted the requirement that all of the blacks sit in the balcony during services. And Wilson reacted vigorously. And if you know any of the Wilson descendants, including John Edgar, you know that a vigorous response is very much in order. Yeah, he kind of does. You could do worse, John. A verbal tongue lashing was followed by a written statement of reasons of protest, which employs both reasoning and biblical argument. He enumerates 13 reasons why their action was sinful. In the face of all that, the session backed down, and blacks and whites continued to sit together in the congregation and at communion. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. He had both barrels loaded the second time. Locked and loaded. Okay, yes. At least if you watch the television. Okay, we turn now to another major advocate against slavery in the generation after J.R. Wilson, and that is a man named after him, James Renick Wilson Sloan, who always went by J.R.W. After an early distinguished career in Ohio and Indiana, and by the way, before he went to seminary, he taught school in Kentucky for a couple of years, then he went to seminary. And he was called in 1856 to be pastor of the Third RP Church in New York City. In New York, he played a role on the national stage, both as a leading preacher in the city and as a fearless abolitionist. His sermons were published or summarized in the New York Times and the Tribune. And as a speaker, he often shared the platform with such leaders as William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, Henry Ward Beecher, and George B. Cheever. And if you're familiar at all with the abolition movement, those names are magic in the leadership of the movement against slavery. Only a year after coming to New York, Sloan was invited to give the address at the 1857 annual meeting of the New York Anti-Slavery Society. Under the title Slavery in Church and State, he dealt chiefly with the influence of slavery in the nation and in many of the churches. In an uncharacteristically colloquial attack, he referred to the miserable booby theology of the slaveholding churches. He later explained the sharpness of this attack as a reflection of the contempt he had heard, even among the slaveholders in Kentucky, for ministers who attempt to justify slavery on the basis of the Bible. 3 years later, May 29, 1860, Sloan addressed the second annual meeting of the Church Anti-Slavery Society in Tremont Temple in Boston, the meeting we referenced at the beginning of today's presentation. Taking as his title, The Church and Slavery, Sloan focused on the churches and ministers who defended slavery and rebutted in some detail their arguments. And he said, "If there is one reason for which more than any other I hate the slave system, it is the foul disgrace and dishonor which it has brought upon our holy religion. I hate slavery because it has brought Christianity into such disrepute." While Sloan was not a dynamic speaker, he had a gift for vivid language and sharp insight. He cut to the heart of the national controversy when he said, "The sad plight of the country is not political, not legal, not Northern radicals versus Southern fire eaters, but that we cherish a system at war with all laws of natural justice. Therefore, the remedy does not lie in political parties or in the election of a Republican president." And remember that Abraham Lincoln was the first Republican president and he had just been elected. "Rather," he said, "the only remedy is to get rid of the mischief." Christ's first sermon, he said, was an abolition discourse from an incendiary publication called the Book of Isaiah, an anti-slavery book of the Old Testament. We won't go into the principles of exegesis exhibited in that statement, but it was an argument at any rate. Slaves were admitted to membership in the church, the Christian church, in the apostolic period. But there is no proof that slaveholders were admitted as members. Now, the first thing we think about is, what about Philemon and Onesimus? Well, during the antebellum period, there was a lot of argument among theologians about Philemon and Onesimus, whether Philemon really was a slave or whether he was simply an employee who had left without leave. Without leave, so to speak. Anyway, after the war began, he preached a sermon which was printed in full on the front page of the New York Times on December 1, 1861. Now, you think about it, the importance of the fact that the New York Times and the Tribune and so on covered these things. Ministers were held in very high regard in that society, much more so than in today's society. And so what a minister said in the pulpit mattered to people. And what J.R.W. Sloan said in the Third RP Church on December the 1st, 1861, his text was from Exodus 5:1. Thus says the Lord of hosts, let my people go. Freeing the slaves, he said, is necessary in order to secure a moral basis for the war and a claim upon the sympathy of foreign nations. Revolutions never go back, and if these states are ever to be restored, they will be as free and not as slaveholding states. He was prescient in that. He knew where it had to end. And he was confident of that because he knew the God of the Bible. I want to take, I've still got a few minutes here, I want to take a minute to read a little bit to you from the book Half a Century by Jane Grey Ken and Swisshelm, which I mentioned at first. And I forget who it was, but somebody told me that they had gone out and read the book the next week. And I think you would find it interesting if you would do that. At one point, her husband, now they lived in what's now Wilkinsburg, and her husband decided that he wanted to go into business with his brother in Kentucky. And, of course, the wife didn't have any say in the matter in those days. And so they went down the river to Kentucky. Samuel, that is the brother-in-law, met us. And as we went in a hack to the boarding place, he had engaged. I wondered what had happened that so many men were off work in the middle of the forenoon. Who or what could they be, these fellows in shining black broadcloth, each with a stovepipe hat on the side of his head, his thumbs in the armholes of a satin vest, displaying a wonderful glimmer of gold chains and diamond stud, balancing himself first on his heels and then on his toes as he rolled a cigar from one side of his mouth to the other. How did they come to be standing around on corners and doorsteps by the hundred, like crows on a cornfield fence? It was some time before I learned that this was the advance guard of a great army of woman whippers, which stretched away back to the Atlantic and around the shores of the Gulf of Mexico, and that they were out on duty as a staring brigade whose business it was to insult every woman who ventured on the street without a male protector by a stare so lascivious as could not be imagined on American free soil. I learned that they all lived in whole or in part by the sale of their own children and the labor of the mothers extorted by the lash. I came to know one hoary-headed veteran whose entire support came from the natural increase in wages of 19 women, one of whom, a girl of 18, lived with him in a fashionable boarding house, waited on him at table, slept in his room, and of whose yearly wages, $175, were credited to his board bill. I learned that none of the shapely hands displayed on the black vests had ever used another implement of toil than a pistol, bowie knife, or slave whip, that any other tool would ruin the reputation of the owner of the tapered digits. But they did not lose caste by horsewhipping the old mammies from whose bosoms they had drawn life in infancy. And then a little bit later, she describes their situation had changed a little, and she says, "We needed a servant, a Kentucky gentleman," which she puts in quotes, "full 6'3", with broad shoulders and heavy black whiskers, came to say, 'I have a woman I can let you have, a good cook, good washer and ironer, first-rate housekeeper. I'll let you have her for $200 a year. But I'll tell you honest, you'll have to horsewhip her yourself about twice a week. For that wife of yours could never do anything with her.' While he talked, I looked. His suit was of the finest black broadcloth, satin vest, a pompous display of chains, seals, studs, and rings, his beaver on the back of his head, his thumbs in the arms of his vest, and feet spread like the Colossus of Rhodes. This new use for Pennsylvania muscle seemed to strike my husband as infinitely amusing, for he burst out laughing and informed the gentleman that he did not follow the profession of whipping women and must decline his offer. But I wanted to be back on free soil, out of an atmosphere which killed all manhood and furnished woman whippers as a substitute for men." Okay, next week we'll talk about Covenanters in the Underground Railroad. And many of you have stories from your family or from your home church related to that. There's a lot of folklore about it, but we'll see how Covenanters were involved in that operation to secure the freedom of runaway slaves. Thank you. Swiss Helm. Jane Gray Cannon Swiss Helm. Her family were named Cannon, and they lived here.